2012, February 1st. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 20, The History of Life on Earth. Well, we're continuing along this theme of life on Earth, and the last two lectures have looked at the possible origins of life on Earth, how we go from non-life to living things, the first living things. And yesterday we talked in some detail about the quest to find the earliest living fossil forms of life, the earliest evidence of life. And what we found was that life got going pretty fast after the Earth settled down, after the end of late heavy bombardment at the end of the Hadean Aeon. Today what we're going to do is now take that starting point, pretty much from where we left it yesterday, and run all the way to the present and do a very quick overview of the history of all life. Call this the history of the Earth's life abridged. But we're going to hit certain highlights that are essential pieces that we're going to touch upon for looking at the history of life, not only on Earth, but some ideas of what we might go looking for when we look at other places. So today we're going to be doing an overview of the history of life. So we're going to look at a series of events that really characterize the history of life on Earth. The first of these was that during this, after the end of the Archean Aeon, which is when we saw the stromatolites, into the Proterozoic Aeon, there was a very rapid diversification of anaerobic prokaryotes. Those are prokaryotes, single-celled life without any cell nucleus, that live without oxygen. Remember, this is an Earth that looks very different from the Earth we see today. There's no oxygen in the atmosphere. It starts out with a relatively heavy carbon dioxide and nitrogen atmosphere. So there's no oxygen yet, and probably not much by way of photosynthesis. At some point during the Proterozoic, we see the rise of dominance of photosynthesis, of conversion of carbon dioxide and water into oxygen, although it didn't always start that way, and began to see the rise of oxygen content in the Earth's atmosphere. This was not also direct. There were a couple bumps along the road that are important to us about where the oxygen first went, was turned out into mineral oxidation, and then went into the atmosphere. But once it went into the atmosphere, things started to change pretty rapidly, because oxygen in the atmosphere opens up the door to oxygen-based metabolism rather than carbon-based metabolism. And that's where we start seeing the rise of eukaryotic forms of life, more complex cells than the prokaryotes, eventually leading at the end of the Proterozoic and the beginning of the Phanerozoic Aeon, which is the present time, the so-called Cambrian explosion about 500 million years ago, in which we saw a tremendous explosion in the biodiversity of animal life and animal life forms, body plans, some 500 million years ago. This is the last major burst of biodiversity on our planet. Everything that then happens subsequently during the Phanerozoic is a tremendous growth of biodiversity built on those basic plans over the last 500 million years. We're going to see how, in fact, when we talk about life, remember we're talking about marine life, life in the water. Colonization of the land, first by plants and then by animals, was a relatively slow process. It didn't occur geologically until relatively recently. But once it got onto land, and land became colonized by life pretty heavily about 300-400 million years ago, we see the rapid change in the diversity of land life that leads first to, eventually, the emergence of primates, and then hominids, and then finally humans within the geological record. A lot goes on very slowly and then explodes in the Cambrian at the start of the Phanerozoic, but we're a relatively late arrival, as we're going to see towards the end. And this sets the stage for understanding the history of life on Earth, gives us some important clues as to what we might expect when we go looking for life elsewhere in the universe. So that's the goal of today. Obviously, I'm sweeping a lot of detail under the rug because I'm hitting the high points that are going to be important to us in the sections that come later. So it's a very highly selective view of the history of life. Now, before I do this, in order to make the notation a lot simpler to deal with, I want to introduce a notation I have not yet used, and that is the so-called YA notation, which is a shorthand for years ago. This is very often used in this literature, in your book, and other discussions of this. So it's a way of simply notating what it takes in words a lot of things to say. When I say 3.5 billion years ago, or 454 million years ago, I need a way to shorthand that. And so there's two of shorthands we're going to use. GYA, which stands for giga years ago. So for example, 3.5 billion years ago would be expressed numerically as 3.5 GYA. And MYA, which is mega years or million years ago. And so 450 million years written out ago in long form is 454 MYA. Now, occasionally you're going to see, if you go Googling around on this subject or you've studied it in other classes, you may see an even shorter version, GA and MA, but I'm going to avoid that. I prefer to keep the Y in there so you can pretty much say this million years ago. G, you sort of say billion years ago, or no one ever says giga years. Gigabytes is about as much as it gets, but we're kind of stuck with the G as the international symbol for a billion. So I'm going to use this notation a lot, although I will say in words, billion years ago, million years ago. This is the shorthand notation you'll see in the notes. And it'll pop up, maybe on the quiz and elsewhere when we talk about the history of life. So let's now remind ourselves what the four eons are of geologic time. So far, we've been mostly working in these first two eons, the Hadean eon, between 4.5 and 3.8 billion years ago, which includes the time of the formation of the Earth and the Moon, the formation of the first oceans, and the building of the primordial atmosphere. And I'll remind you that that atmosphere is a carbon dioxide nitrogen atmosphere. There is no oxygen. The present-day atmosphere, as we've seen in previous lectures, looks very different than the original atmosphere of the Earth, and this is an important input on what life is going to be like. Life is going to have to grow up in an anaerobic environment, meaning no oxygen. It's going to have to make oxygen eventually. The second eon, which we spent a lot of time in yesterday, is the Archean. It lasted between 3.8 and 2.5 billion years ago, and is really the time of the stromatolites, the first real recognizable forms of life that survived in the fossil record, these large-scale microbe mats of sediment that built up, and the fossil bacteria that we find during the late Archean. The handful of survivals of single-celled organism, and they're all single-celled prokaryotes, bacteria, and a few that are very likely archaea. But the things that distinguish a bacterium from an archaea are destroyed by the fossilization process. So we can only go on shape. So the Hadean is the formation of the Earth and the building of the oceans and atmosphere. The Archean is the first appearance of very simple forms of prokaryotic life. The real thing we're going to be concentrating on today is picking up the story very quickly from the Archean and jumping forward into the Proterozoic, which was an eon that lasted about 2 billion years, between about 2.5 billion years ago and about 450 million years ago. And I realize I've written that down wrong again. Bloody hell. That should be 500 million years ago. Ignore that. My apologies. And then finally, I'm going to change it right. This is offending me. Okay. Let's just use the magic of PowerPoint here. I thought I got rid of all those, so I'm just going to make them look like that. Come on, don't want to turn my volume up, 450. I apologize. I looked at this thing probably 100 times in the last little bit. All right, there we go. That's better. The Proterozoic period lasted about 202 billion years. It's a very long period in which we see the rise of eukarya, cells with nuclei and other complex organelles and bodies, mitochondria, Golgi bodies, things like that. And we see the beginning of the rise of oxygen. This is going to be the period where photosynthesis begins to grab hold. Finally, the place that we're really interested in is the last 500 million years, called the Phanerozoic. That's the present day, all packed down here. This is where we see the rise of plant and animal life. So before this, for the previous 3 billion years, going back to the first real signs of life about 3.5 billion years ago in the oldest stromatolites, up to the first emergence of complex multicellular animals, 3 billion years elapses. Everything we see from the simplest animal forms to us all fits in the last half billion years of the Earth's history. And it gets even crazier when we start looking in detail at us. And we'll see that as we go along. So this diagram sets the main stage. So let's begin. The Archean eon began with the end of the late period of heavy bombardment about 3.8 billion years ago. The conditions on the Earth stabilized. There were no longer sterilizing impacts. The oceans were built, but there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. The atmosphere was primarily built by a combination of the gases delivered by the comets and asteroids that were smacking the Earth during the Hadean, plus outgassing from volcanoes. Volcanoes outgas carbon dioxide, water vapor, nitrogen, various sulfides and other nasties, but mostly carbon dioxide, water vapor, sulfides, and nitrogen. Over time, because the planet was building oceans, there was liquid water, you began the process of setting up a carbon cycle, and that carbon cycle slowly scrubbed the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, locking it up, first dissolving it into the oceans, and then slowly locking it up into carbonaceous minerals that sank down into sediments on the seafloor. So this process is characterized by a steady scrubbing of carbon dioxide out of the system. It's fairly efficient, but it's pretty slow. We don't have some extra help like photosynthetic plant life, which also scrubs carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, was not available to help. The first stromatolites appear in the geological record only about 300 million years after the end of late heavy bombardment, about 3.5 billion years ago, and thrived for about 1 billion years. So this kind of composite drawing here of a modern volcano and a modern stromatolite field show you probably what the Archean Earth probably looked like, except the sky probably wasn't as pretty a blue during the early Archean. It was probably a bit steamier than that. What we see is through this period, because we're working in an anoxic environment, an environment with no oxygen, the primary forms of life are going to be anaerobic. They're going to be microbes that utilize either carbon dioxide or methane that are going to arise primarily in the deep oceans. We're still talking about marine life, and maybe on shallow shores, like the stromatolites, use probably chemosynthesis to produce their energy. So they build up carbon, either carbon or methane, from the atmosphere, from the oceans, and then use chemosynthesis, energy derived from inorganic oxidation, to provide for their energy. And that's how these creatures grew. They're anaerobic. Oxygen is a poison to them. Now, this period is a period of fairly rapid diversification. We see a lot of changes in the fossil record of the types of anaerobic microbes that appeared in the fossil record through this period. But the diversification was small in the sense that it was all sort of one type of life, and it was pretty slow. We're talking about a period of about 1 billion years. So between when life arose during the early Archean to the end of the Archean and the beginning of the next eon, the Proterozoic, when the first real big change in life occurred that makes you say, yeah, things are different here and you want to draw a boundary, was about 1 billion years. The next boundary in life comes about 2.5 billion years ago and is going to last for about 2 billion years. It's the longest eon of all of them in the geologic record. It's called the Proterozoic, the first life eon. Now, its name was given before the real recognition of life in the Archean, but it's also still germane. They haven't rearranged it because it's during this period that we find the really first solid microfossil evidence of prokaryotes, of recognizable prokaryotes structurally. We can certainly see the remnants and stromatolites, but the first real fossils come from about 2.5 billion years ago. The other thing that we see the emergence of that's a major change in life forms on this planet 2.5 billion years ago is the increasing dominance of photosynthesis, the use of sunlight rather than inorganic oxidation as the source of energy for fixing carbon out of the atmosphere with water. Now, the first forms of photosynthesis did not actually use water. It actually used hydrogen sulfide. We see a lot of sulfur-loving bacteria, both in the fossil record and a few survivals among certain extremophile populations. So this early version of photosynthesis, which is energetically a little bit faster, doesn't produce oxygen. It produces sulfur compounds. Desulfafabas, for example, are pretty common with this. However, once you begin to do this kind of photosynthesis, once you open up the process through natural selection to begin to use a water-based photosynthesis, that's when you start producing oxygen. So this process occurred pretty quickly. The transition was only about 100 or 200 million years between the first appearance of photosynthesis and the first appearance of photosynthesis that was water and carbon dioxide-based that produced oxygen as a byproduct. Remember, to a photosynthetic organism, oxygen is a waste product. Carbon dioxide is what it breathes or takes out of dissolved water. And the first evidence we see for really green-type bacteria, photosynthetic bacteria, is about 2.4 billion years ago. So this was a very rapid change. Once you set up photosynthesis, and this probably occurred relatively early, there's some evidence it goes back into at least the late Archean, but once you set up oxygen photosynthesis, it's a very much more efficient way to go. It's using a lot more abundant material, water, than hydrogen sulfide. So it's a combination. Remember, it isn't just simply pure absolute efficiency. It's efficiency plus the amount of raw materials. You can have a super efficient process, but if it uses a rare material, it's not going to go very far. So if you even have a process with slightly less efficiency, like water-based photosynthesis, but you got water everywhere, suddenly you get a lot of gain just from crossing the relative inefficiency with a huge abundance of raw materials. So the problem with this, of course, it starts pumping out oxygen. But the oxygen doesn't necessarily go to life right away because there's nothing that can use oxygen. This is all anaerobic life. Oxygen is a poison to it. So where does the oxygen go? And the answer is it actually gets very quickly soaked up by the environment because you've got a lot of minerals around, particularly iron and sulfur, but iron in particular. Iron in the presence of oxygen is fearsomely reactive and it makes rust. It makes iron oxide. And these sinks of oxygen are very, very strong. So strong they've left deep marks in the geological record. So most of the initial, once photosynthesis gets going with water, you start pumping out oxygen just left and right. But that oxygen goes pretty much almost immediately into mineral oxidation. The way this is found in the geological record is we suddenly see the appearance about 2.4 billion years ago of very large numbers of these banded oxygen formations. They're sedimentary rocks which are banded together between sediments, these very bright red iron oxide features. It's basically compressed rust. These things built up very quickly on the ocean beds as part of the marine sediments. If you look at these iron oxide layers, we find these all over the planet, although there's a few places where they kind of bust through from the early Proterozoic. One of those places is up in Minnesota, where this is the reason why there's a great big iron oxide mining operation in Minnesota. If we add up how much of this stuff is in the ocean sediments, we find a really remarkable fact. The amount of oxygen that's locked up as iron oxide and sulfur oxides in these sediments is 20 times the oxygen abundance in our current atmosphere. So there's 20 times more oxygen in these sinks of mineral oxidation than is actually free oxygen in the air today. So these are a huge sink. So this is so efficient of an oxidation process that pretty much the minute these little bugs made oxygen photosynthetically, the stuff went right into mineral oxidation. And this, of course, is pretty good to us. Most of the modern iron ore industry is mining this stuff. So we kind of have benefit of the first forms of photosynthesis is actually the driver of the iron industry for the most part. Just like our energy industry comes from coal, as we're going to see in a moment. Now, this major sink lasts until you actually soak up all the oxygen you're going to get. We say that the sink begins to saturate. You can think of the iron, bare iron, as kind of like a sponge. If there's any oxygen, it's going to sponge it up. But out, just like a sponge, once you fill it full of water and it saturates, you can't push any more water into the sponge. The water pours off. The same thing happens with mineral oxidation sinks. When you saturate the sink, the oxygen's still getting pumped out by the little photosynthetic buggies, and where it goes is straight into the atmosphere. And this change occurred. Okay, the first photosynthesis kicks on around 2.4 billion years ago. It immediately starts getting soaked up. We see these huge banded formations that are 2 billion years old. And then all of a sudden, about 1.8 billion years ago, we stop seeing heavy banded iron formations. The oxygen's got to go somewhere, and where it goes is straight into the atmosphere. So once you saturate these mineral sinks, these iron and sulfur sinks, for forming mineral oxides, the oxygen goes straight into the atmosphere and it builds up very, very rapidly in a geologic sense. And within a half a billion years, you get very quickly up to about the oxygen levels we see in the present day. Now, this causes a real crisis for life on Earth. This is, in fact, probably the trigger of the first major mass extinction on the planet. Because all the life up to this point is anaerobic. It works with carbon dioxide and water and either sunlight or mineral oxidation to make stuff. But if you make oxygen, oxygen is a poison to an anaerobic life form. It actually chokes them off and kills it. So you end up with a problem is that you get the photosynthesis is slowly poisoning most of the life in the biosphere. And what you end up with is as the oxygen levels begin to rise in the atmosphere, and remember, we're still talking about marine creatures. There's nothing on the land yet. You basically get a mass extinction of the prokaryotes, except where they're protected from that oxygen. And that's going to be in the deep oceans and deep underground, where the oxygen can't seep in. This is where we're seeing a tremendous overturn in life on Earth. Those creatures that are oxygen tolerant, the photosynthetic life, are somewhat oxygen tolerant. If you're able to survive aerobically, even if you don't use oxygen for metabolism, you have now a selective edge against evolution. You're living in an environment which is poison to most of the anaerobic prokaryotes. So what you see is a massive overturning in the balance of life. You see the anaerobic prokaryotes mostly going extinct, except deep in the earth and deep near undersea vents, where they remain to this day as some of the extremophiles we see, and the rise of photosynthetic oxygen-tolerant prokaryotes, aerobic bacteria rather than anaerobic bacteria. And when you have the starting of oxygen as a source of metabolism and all of the interesting oxygen chemistry that can go on, you also start to now see the beginning of the emergence of a new form of life, the eukaryotes. So, at this point, we're 1.8 billion years in. We're 2 billion years. So the emergence of life is like 3.5 billion years ago. The end of the last heavy bombardment was 3.8 billion years ago. For 2 billion years, life on Earth was anaerobic bacteria. But once we had the rise of photosynthesis and saturated the mineral sinks 1.8 billion years ago, the sudden rise in oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere leads to a crisis and an extinction, and we now open up a channel to completely new forms of life. Why did it change? The mass extinction opens up huge sections of the environment as ecological niches for new life to radiate into the places that are vacated by the bugs that are dead. The second thing is the presence of oxygen. Begins to become a new source of chemistry that gives you a much more energetic source of chemistry and therefore another source of driving life. What we see is sometime between about 2.1 billion years and 1.8 billion years, when you begin to see the start of the rise of oxygen, is when we first start to see in the Proterozoic eon the rise of the first eukaryotes. We don't know the exact stages by which eukaryotes emerged from prokaryotes, but the best knowledge we've got so far suggests the best model is that you start with very, very large ancestral prokaryotes. So these are big prokaryotes. They don't have a cell nucleus. They got their DNA just kind of bopping around in the membrane bag. But as you make these prokaryotes very big, the bags get kind of loose and floppy. Okay, they're not as tight. They're not like a blown-up balloon. And you begin to get involutions and infoldings of these membranes. Eventually, you can get these membranes begin to break off, and you get membranes within these early prokaryotes. If those membranes can form around the nucleus, think of kind of a prokaryote, what a prokaryote is a membrane containing DNA, but it's surrounded by a bigger kind of uber prokaryote bag around it, and maybe smaller little pieces coming off. These inner membranes, the one that contains all the DNA, becomes the nucleus. These smaller involutions or folding of membranes within the larger outer cell membrane become the organelles, the little Golgi bodies, the mitochondria. So the part of this is the rise of oxygen. The rise of oxygen lets you build bigger prokaryotes, but those bigger prokaryotes become structurally unstable, and it can lead to the change of these first eukaryotes. The eukaryotes, in many ways, are really symbiotic systems, we think. They're colonized by multiple different types of prokaryotes, in which the whole becomes much bigger than the sum of the parts of these things. For example, in animal cells today, we have mitochondria, which are the centers of power source inside of cells. Where the ATP cycle runs in animal cells is in the mitochondria. But if you look at the mitochondria, what you see is the mitochondria actually have their own DNA. They have ATP catalytic cycle going on in a membrane. They look like a standalone prokaryote. They just happen to be embedded within this larger eukaryotic cell. In plant cells, you see these bodies called chloroplasts, a membrane containing the chlorophyll, the energy source thing that drives the ATP cycle through the Calvin cycle, plus the DNA bopping around. If you take apart the chloroplasts, which are now contained within larger plant cells in modern plants, you find that chloroplasts contain little snippets of DNA. They're like little photosynthetic bacteria living inside this larger eukaryotic cell. So the symbiosis of different types of prokaryotes in one big involuted bag is a remnant of this particular evolutionary direction. And in an evolutionary sense, remember, any changes in structure that give you a greater advantage, especially a greater advantage in energy utilization, perhaps, by being able to compartmentalize your energy production, be it photosynthesis or oxygen metabolism powered by ATP, gives you an edge. So these organelles and the nucleus, which helps keep the genetic material contained, gave these cells that developed these a tremendous evolutionary edge, and you began to see the rise of the eukaryotes. Once you form eukaryotes, which are more complex and greater diversity can apply, evolution begins to accelerate. We saw 2 billion years of anaerobic bacteria. We go from the first eukaryotes at 2.1 billion years to the rise of multicellular eukaryotes within less than a billion years later. By 1.2 billion years ago, we see the first true multicellular eukaryotic life. There are fossils of red algae that have exact analogs to modern red algae today. Their modern-day descendants, both structurally and functionally, are easily recognizable, even at a distance of nearly 1.2 billion years. Here's some examples of some of these fossil red algae. They're almost indistinguishable from modern forms. The only difference is these are fossilized, and the modern forms are living. In fact, the multi-celled creatures probably started out as single-cell colonies. We know that prokaryotes form big mats of things. You do the same thing with eukaryotes. But with the eukaryotes growing up in development next to each other, you begin to develop some specialized cell function. One group of cells down here is particularly well-suited to, say, anchoring to rock. Other cells might be heavy in the chloroplasts at the top. And so you begin to see the formation of structures where a particular colony, which has an ability to hang on its feet and concentrate its photosynthetic stuff at the top, has an advantage over those that are the same from top to bottom, that are free-floating and kind of have their photosynthesis running throughout. Anything that gives you an edge in this highly competitive environment for resources is going to give natural selection something to work on and pass down to your offspring. But what's particularly interesting is at some time in this period, around 1.2 billion years ago, we see the first emergence of sexual reproduction. Up to this point, for all of the history of life on the Earth, reproduction was asexual, the simple splitting of cells. If you split off a cell into two pieces, you carry pretty much exact copies of yourself. There's not much room for diversity. And remember, it's genetic diversity that drives natural selection at the molecular level. But once you have sexual reproduction, where you make offspring by getting half of your genes from one parent and half from the other, you've opened up a tremendous channel to very large amounts of genetic diversity. That genetic diversity is the lubricant for natural selection. And the whole thing begins to accelerate because now you have greater genetic variation because you're now doing your reproduction with two pieces from two different parents. And whenever you do that, you begin to accelerate, and we're going to see in the fossil record, a rapid acceleration of evolution driven by natural selection. So the pace begins to pick up really fast. What's important about this is the formation both of multicellular forms of life that begin to develop specialized cells throughout the system, and the development of sexual reproduction, is we have a tremendous multiplier on natural selection. The whole starts to become greater than the sum of its parts. Biodiversity now has something to actually begin with. We have much better raw materials to start branching out into developing the diversity of life. So this, again, this begins around 1.2 billion years ago and begins cruising along. What we're going to see is that while biodiversity begins to evolve relatively rapidly now. Before we had 2 billion years of boredom. Now we're going to do everything within about 800 million years, 700 to 800 million years between 1.2 billion years ago and 500 million years ago. That's about 700 million years ago if I do the math right. The biggest change we start seeing in life through this period comes during this late Proterozoic eon, and it comes really late, about 580 million years ago. At this point, the Proterozoic's only got about 40, 50 million years to run before we change into the Phanerozoic. And what we see is a sudden change of very complex multicellular biota, macroscopic appearance of the first things that look like they might become animals in life. Now, a lot of these, here's a picture of one of these fossils, is part of a group of fauna or biota called the Ediacara. Ediacara is named for the place in Australia, in southern Australia, where these fossils were first found. You can see start of the patternings we see in advanced life. Structure on high levels, specialized cells. We don't really know too much about what these are because none of the Ediacara survived to the present day. This particular lineage went extinct pretty rapidly. It's pretty clear that the way these things emerged was at the end of the last snowball Earth episode recorded in geologic history. There were two snowball Earth records in history. The very last one ended in the late Proterozoic, about 580 million years ago. This caused a tremendous amount of extinction. When the ice began to melt and we came out of snowball Earth, there were a large number of ecological niches opened up, and some of the marine creatures that had evolved during this period and managed to survive it were very complex. These complex creatures began to radiate into those suddenly opened up niches as the ice began to move away. Now, so far what we know is these things were probably pretty soft-bodied. There's no shells or any hard edges to these things. And they were fairly abundant right up to the start of the Cambrian Eon. They probably used oxygen for metabolism. There's a lot of different diversity in here, but they're all pretty simple patterns. They're all kind of these flattish-looking things. At this point, we're bringing ourselves up to about 500 million years ago, 580 million years ago, and the world is about to change dramatically. And the dramatic change occurs at the end of the Proterozoic and the beginning of the Phanerozoic. Through the Proterozoic, we have the buildup of the oldest eukaryotes, we have the buildup of oxygen in the atmosphere, we have the steady change in the Earth's atmosphere, we have a couple snowball Earth episodes occur in through here, but at the end of that last snowball Earth episode, right at the end of the Proterozoic, we see the rise of the first really complex, almost animal-like biota, the Ediacara, and then the world changes. And the world changes in a way in which we see a literal explosion in biodiversity, driven by abundant oxygen to power oxygen-based metabolism, and by combination of sexual reproduction and the emergence of the first complex forms of life that give a tremendous edge, basically a tremendous amount of raw material for natural selection to work on, and evolution literally explodes on the Earth. This all occurred about 540 million years ago at the beginning of the Phanerozoic, and now the whole history of life gets interesting. It becomes this power zoom down here. Through those of you who studied geology will recognize the names of all the periods of geologic history. We're not going to have you memorize any of this stuff, but we see the sudden change from boring life for 2 billion years ago and then a sudden explosion of plant and animal life that fills the ecological niches of the Earth. So let's look at this explosion that occurred at the start of the Phanerozoic. It's a literal explosion, and it's referred to as the Cambrian explosion, named for that first epoch of the Phanerozoic Eon. What we see is at the start of the Phanerozoic, over a period that occurred only over 40 million years in geology. That's a very, very short time in a geological time frame that takes billions of years. We see the sudden radiation of a huge number of body plans and animals and plants. In fact, we see the emergence of every single basic body plan that we see throughout the animal and plant kingdoms today. We see sponges. Right, these sort of radiating sponge structures that we see among certain types of plants or animals. We see chordates, animals with a protovertebra. We see trilobites, these sort of segmented creatures that look like pill bugs. We see soft velvet worms. We see all of the body plans that we see today. We see their ancestral forms appear first during the Cambrian. None of the body plans of the Ediacara appear in any current day life forms. All of the Ediacara body plans vanished, literally vanished, so far as we know, from the geological record at the start of the Cambrian explosion. This is the last and most major diversification of biological body plans in the entire geological record. After this, it's merely modifications of these body plans based on the Cambrian plans. In fact, many body plans emerged during this period that were to vanish later on from the complete fossil record. There are some really bizarre forms that popped out that never survived the Cambrian. So this is the great sorting out. This is when life basically developed all the major structural forms we're going to see for the following 500 million years. And this is the emergence of the first real complex animals, the first real complex plants. And they radiated out into a virtually empty ecosystem that had been cleared out by the last snowball Earth extinction, and they literally exploded into life on Earth. So this is it. This is the beginning of things that we recognize as life today. The microscopic bacteria, this is when the world changes from nearly 3 billion years of life on Earth being microbes, to life being macroscopic animals and plants. And it all occurred in this last half billion years. The Cambrian explosion is really kind of puzzling in many ways because we don't know what drove it exactly, but we have some ideas. One of these we've already mentioned is abundant oxygen in the atmosphere. Oxygen metabolism is very energetic and can provide the kind of energy that large, complex animals and plants need. So it allows this much greater metabolism. The other thing, reason why there was the explosion, as I've mentioned already before, just to summarize, is because it was a mass extinction by the Snowball Earth episode that occurred at the end of the Proterozoic that would have basically wiped clean a lot of the slate. Not all of it. It didn't wipe the Earth sterile, but it wiped a huge fraction of the Earth's life slate clean, opening up ecological niches for these new types of life to radiate into. So this is what extinctions do for you. They open up ecological niches. They give animals that previously were in the minority a chance to become the majority. It also, these really put huge stresses on the biosphere. And those huge stresses produce strong selection pressure. And strong selection pressure drives rapid evolution. And it's exactly what we see. We see within 40 million years, we go from these relatively boring body plans of the Ediacara to this huge explosion in body plans for plants and animals. Finally, this is going to be aided and abetted by the fact that one of the big differences here, rather than at other times in the past, is that sexual reproduction is the primary form of reproduction for these plants and complex animals. Before, when you have single-celled asexual reproduction, you don't have as much variation in genetics, you don't have that drive. But once you bring sexual reproduction in, you've got a huge pool of variation for natural selection to work upon. And that's all this. That's really what we think is behind this massive explosion. Once this explosion occurred, it basically filled all of the ecological niches on the planet and has been, at least for the last half billion years, highly successful. Since the Cambrian explosion, no new fundamental body plans have emerged anywhere in the geological record. Now, once you got that explosion started, we've got to keep reminding ourselves, we're still in the oceans, we're still in the water. We have not yet gone on to the land. Colonization of the land, which, you know, there's a lot of continental drift going on here, but basically something between 20 and 30% of the Earth's surface was dry land, and the rest was the oceans. The oceans are the cradle of life, period. But how do you get onto the land? There's an awful lot of challenges. Land, while it was abundant, was a really challenging place to be. It wasn't a very friendly place. First and foremost is UV radiation. Our Earth is shielded today by the ozone layer. The ozone layer is built up by having oxygen in the atmosphere. But that ozone layer took a while to build up. Before there was an ozone layer, the ultraviolet radiation is not just simply a mutator, it's fatal. Right? Just like if you had no ozone layer, we wouldn't be able to walk outside without complete sun protection. We'd be getting skin cancer left and right. Basically, UV radiation from the sun is hugely dangerous to biological systems. It breaks up molecules. It breaks up DNA. So before there was an ozone layer to protect the surface from ultraviolet radiation, the land was a bad place to be. It was a hostile environment for high radiation. The other thing is, to live on land, if you're a plant, you've got to get water and you've got to get minerals out of the ground. Well, how do you do that? Well, you've got to evolve roots. That's kind of tough. The other thing is, we usually think of plants growing in soil. There was no soil. Soil is dead organic plant material. So we have 20 to 30% of the Earth's surface is in land, and it's bare, naked rock. There's no soil because there's no plants to make soil. So what we probably end up with is the first plants that colonized the land started out in shallow pools, and they slowly built their own soil. As the waters receded or dried up, they left the soil behind and they grew inside them. As they grow up, the subsequent generations die, leaving their organic material as soil. And you can imagine these little puddles of soil slowly spreading across the land. It's nutrient-rich. It's a medium that gives you immediate start for seeds and other things that can give you plant life. And funguses can have a place to grow. Soil retains water that bare rock does not. And so it helps hold liquid water near an otherwise dry surface. So you first, in order to have colonization of land, you had to have the plants get out there literally to build the soil. This actually happened relatively fast. The Cambrian explosion was about 540 million years. So within about 100 million years, it's really hard to tell, of the Cambrian explosion, by 475 million years ago, the first plants and fungi are beginning to start colonizing the land. The animals followed much more slowly behind them, about 75 million years later. We really don't see the first land animals, mostly kind of insect-type life, until about 400 million years ago. So it's relatively late going. But once the land was colonized, all of a sudden, remember, 20 to 30% of the Earth's surface is land, you've opened up a completely new ecological niche, and life radiated into it relatively fast. Once land was fully colonized, land evolution starts proceeding very rapidly. This brings us up to about 360 million years ago. It's a period called the Carboniferous period. The land is covered in these vast forests of mostly plant life and insect species. There really aren't any large land animals yet. Okay, we're still in the age of insects and little tiny things. This is a huge amount of access to carbon. You now have these plants, photosynthetic plants, that are now scrubbing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The atmosphere's carbon dioxide count is dropping. The atmosphere is getting a little less heavy. The greenhouse effect is backing off a bit. The Earth is kind of this, they like to show these museum pictures, these warm, dense forests covering the land. Of course, when this stuff dies, it collapses down, carrying all the carbon it scrubbed out of the atmosphere, forms the soil. You build up multiple layers of soil. Eventually, remember, the land is fairly geologically active. You subduct that, and you subject all this carbon-rich stuff to the compression and heating of the subsurface. What do you get? Coal. Highly concentrated carbon. The coal mines out in Virginia, in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, they're tapping into the dead plant material from the Carboniferous, the carbon-bearing period. This is, in fact, the main layer, the coal we're mining, is from this brief period when plants ruled the Earth. And we're scrubbing huge amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, locking in the plant life. And of course, what are we doing? We're digging it up, and we're putting the carbon dioxide back in the atmosphere after it's been safely locked away for 400 million years. But that's a different story. So plant life, animal life, colonized the land about 400 million years ago, 300 million years ago. It's pretty much insects, little tiny things, and plants. But the big change, the last big change, occurs in the Earth about 250 million years ago. That's when we see the emergence of the first two major groups of animals that colonized the land, the dinosaurs and the mammals. They both arose about the same time. Mammals and dinosaurs appear together in the fossil record. The oldest proto-dinosaurs, protosauropods, proto-mammals, arguably between about 250 and 240 million years ago. Okay. The first really solid ones about 220 million years ago were they're really recognizable dinosaurs, but the prototypes are there. The dinosaurs are the most successful in this environment, and they literally rule the Earth between about 155 million years, between about 200 million years ago until about 65 million years ago. They were on top. The biggest top of the right at the top of the food chain was Tyrannosaurus Rex, the biggest badass this planet's ever seen. But that didn't mean a thing when the asteroid hit 65 million years ago and completely turned over the environment. All of a sudden, you couldn't support big animals that had to eat hundreds of pounds of meat a day. You couldn't support land vegetarians that were the size of houses that had to eat literally tons of vegetation a month to survive. The things that survived were the things that were able to live in the little tiny niches with small amounts of food. These little fur balls called the mammals. When the asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs, it scrubbed a huge section of the biosphere clean of the biggest land species, left surviving a handful of small survivals. The remaining dinosaurs are birds, in fact. It's the theropods. The last theropods are, in fact, things like chickens. If you're wondering what a dinosaur tastes like, probably tastes like chicken. And the mammals. And the mammals began to radiate into these niches as the Earth recovered from the asteroid impact to the present day. And mammals took over about 65 million years ago between the Cretaceous and Tertiary. We're going to say a little bit more about that impact tomorrow. The last bit of the story is, shortly after the mammals arose, there were a series of events that are interesting specifically to us, namely about 58 million years ago, very simple ancestral primates split off into two lineages. One of the lineages goes up to the lemurs, the lories, the tarsiers, the potos, the little funky little things that look like sort of miniature monkeys but aren't, that live out in places like Madagascar. And they broke off into a lineage of early primates. that continued bopping along until about 38, 40 million years ago, when there was the first major bifurcation in the primates. The monkeys, old world and new world, branched off, and the apes branched off in the other direction. Never call a gorilla or a chimpanzee a monkey. They're apes. They're part of this lineage that busted off about 40 million years ago. This lineage had its next major fissioning about 5 million years later, or 35 million years ago, when the gibbons, the big long-armed tree-living apes, almost said monkey there, broke off and left this other lineage, which stayed pretty constant until in the fossil record about 15 million years ago, underwent a major division. The major division were into the gorillas and orangutans, and then finally 7 or 8 million years ago, one group of these broke into the pongidae, the chimpanzees, and to early forms of hominids, the first form of proto-human beings. So through this period, things that even look marginally like a future human being, but are not yet modern humans, are 6 or 7 million years ago. Homo sapiens, the first things that look like recognizable modern humans, do not appear in the fossil record until between 200,000 and 400,000 years ago. Notice what's happened to our time scales. We've gone from billions of years to millions of years to thousands of years. This is not in your notes, but I'm going to throw up just to give you a perspective on this problem. We're interested in life in the universe because we're really interested in an intelligent life in the universe. Here are two remarkable human artifacts that are 30,000 years old. On the left are sketches of horses 35,000 years old from the Prince Chauvet Pontoir cave. Absolutely recognizable as modern horses. On the right, a human-animal hybrid figurine called the Lion Man from the Stadel cave in Germany, dated with carbon dating to 32,000 years old. We recognize these as modern human because they represent a truly human activity, abstract representation. It's 35,000 years old. The difference between us and 35,000 years ago, compared to the history we've just seen, is 35,000 years out of 3.5 billion. So since the emergence of life on Earth to the recognizable emergence of a truly human characteristic is 1/100,000th the span. If I was to shrink that whole 3.5 billion year history of life into 1 year, the emergence of modern human beings is less than 1 second. Intelligence is an eye blink in geological history. See you all tomorrow.